We're going to get started. If you please take your seats. This is the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs, and today is Wednesday, February 21st. And we're going to start today. This is an oversight hearing of the Metropolitan Council. There will be no bills heard today. The bills that we have regarding the Metropolitan Council will be on Monday. We will hear any bill that anyone has introduced regarding the Metropolitan Council. We're going to take care of all of the issues on one day. So don't come in a week or 2 weeks and say, I have a bill on the Met Council. Please get it in. Even if it doesn't have a number, bring me the bill, and we will put it on the agenda with the XXX files on it. Okay? That includes your members as well. Okay? Right. If you would tell them that, that'd be great. All right. With that, Mr. Bell, go ahead. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Of course. Representative Hilstrom, my name is Peter Bell. I'm chair of the Metropolitan Council. It's a pleasure to be before your committee once again. There are six items we are going to touch on today, and I will briefly outline what those are, and then we will have presenters for all six. The first is our comprehensive planning process in the seven-county region. And in reviewing that item, we will also touch on the Metropolitan Land Planning Act. The second area we're going to focus on today is the Livable Communities Program. As committee members are aware, there are three grant programs in the Livable Communities grant program, and we're going to touch on or provide an overview of all three of those grant programs. The third area, Representative Hilstrom, we're going to focus on is our HRA. We have in our Housing and Redevelopment Authority 5900 Section 8 certificates. We provide that service primarily to small communities in the Seven County metropolitan area, and we're going to provide an overview on that. The third area, Representative Hilstrom, we're going to talk about is what we call I&I, or inflow infiltration in our wastewater system. That's essentially a issue to deal with the amount of what we term clear water coming into our wastewater system that is being treated, and it doesn't need to be treated, and that the possible expenditures relating to that are significant. We'll provide an overview of that. The fourth area is our water supply planning. The legislature charged us with looking at water supply issues, primarily regarding two issues, the availability and the safety of water supply. And then the final area we're going to focus on, Representative Hilstrom, is the 2007 legislative initiatives that we have. So those are the six areas. And with that, Judge, should we have the first person come forward?
Sure.
Mr. Shetland.
Hey, Madam Chair, Judge Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. And we have a number of staff from the Met Council who are going to be able to provide the additional detail that that your committee has requested on these different issue areas. And I'm going to start with Mark Vandershaft, who's our Director of Planning and Growth Management. So he will be our Growth Manager. Excuse me.
Please come to the table. Mr. Shetland, just to let you know, I'm going to encourage members to interrupt with their questions, but I will attempt to make certain that we have time to finish the entire presentation as well. So in the event we need to have deeper discussion around a subject area, I will encourage them to interrupt. So go ahead, please state your name for the record.
My name is Mark Vandershaft, Madam Chair. My job title is Director of Planning and Growth Management. And I noticed it was stated a little bit differently in your agenda. We'll try not to go there, though. I do also have with me today our planning manager, Phyllis Hansen, who will be available to assist with questions if you have them. What I will be doing is providing an overview of the comprehensive planning process in the Twin Cities area. And the first slide you're seeing indicates what we mean when we talk about the Twin Cities area. According to statute, the geographic scope of the metropolitan area is seven counties, which currently encompasses 138 cities and 44 townships. The statutes that refer that specifically define metropolitan planning in the Twin Cities area are found in Chapter 473 of the statutes, the Metropolitan Land Planning Act. And I think the point I would emphasize on this slide is that as defined by statute, metropolitan planning is a partnership between metropolitan council and local communities. It is not something that just one side does. The Metropolitan Council is responsible for developing regional plans and administering a process for metropolitan planning. Local communities are responsible for developing local comprehensive plans, and we'll be talking then more today about what that involves. I think one of the easiest ways to understand the metropolitan planning process is to see it as a 10-year cycle, as this next slide illustrates. As with all cycles, cycles don't have a genuine starting point, but I think a convenient starting point is to think of the census that comes out every 10 years as the beginning of this, of each new cycle. When the census is done, we get a lot of data that there are things we can learn about our metropolitan area that we didn't understand quite so well prior to the release of the census. And so that is what triggers a process for creating the regional planning framework, which appears, as we'll talk about a little bit later here, initially in a document we call the development framework. When it was the most recent development framework that was approved in the year 2004 is a development framework up through the year 2030. That's followed by the release of system plans, which we'll also speak of in more detail. And then at about the middle of the decade, a kind of a handoff between the Metropolitan Council and local communities as the content of system plans are communicated to local communities, which begins a process of local comprehensive plan updates. When that is completed, and in this decade, those are due to be completed by the end of 2008, that prepares us then for the beginning of a new cycle when the next round of census data come in.
I'm going to interrupt you for just one moment. For many of the new members on the committee, the Metropolitan Council has to approve comprehensive local comprehensive plans. And if you could talk a little bit about what happens if you don't agree with the comprehensive plan that is submitted and if there is consequences that you have the ability to use. So with that, Mr. Vander.
Okay. Yes, technically the Metropolitan Council reviews local comprehensive plans for three levels of agreement with regional policy, for conformance with regional system plans, which again we'll talk about in a little bit, consistency with regional policy, and compatibility with plans from neighboring communities. On the basis of that review, then, the council normally allows local communities to put their plans into effect. It can require, on rare occasions, a plan modification if there is believed to be a substantial impact on regional system plans. Again, that's something very rare, but that's the mechanism that's described in statute to deal with that situation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So starting then with the development framework that is prepared on the basis of census data and on analysis of regional policy that comes out of that. The current framework is the 2030 Development Framework, and it is a document that is based, it basically elaborates four basic policies, which you see illustrated in this slide. The first policy, to accommodate growth in a flexible, connected, and efficient manner. The second policy is to slow the growth in traffic congestion and improve mobility. The third policy, to encourage housing choices. And the fourth policy, to conserve, protect, and enhance vital natural resources. Now, these are the four basic policies. There is a recognition, though, on the part of Metropolitan Council that these policies will properly be applied in different ways in different parts of the metropolitan area. And indeed, the policy document elaborates different policy emphases for developed communities, which are the central cities and the inner ring suburbs, typically, developing communities on the edge of suburban development, and then several types of rural communities have different applications of these policies as well. One size does not fit all. It depends on the type of community and the stage of growth that one is in, how the policies are applied. Based on the development framework then, which in this case was adopted in January of 2004, the Metropolitan Council then goes on to develop more detailed policies relating to the regional systems that are assigned to us as responsibilities by statutes. There are technically four regional systems. Two of them are typically combined, and in fact they have been combined in our system plans. Transportation and aviation are defined by statute as regional systems. There is a single plan that covers both of those systems. An additional system then is water resources, and then the final system that Metropolitan Council has responsibility for as a regional system is the regional park system.
I'm going to interrupt you for just one moment. We now officially have a quorum. I will formally call this meeting to order. Go ahead.
Okay. The next slide tells a little bit more about, not about the system plans themselves, but the translation of the system plans into a local context. As we mentioned at the beginning, there are approximately 190 communities that are part of the Twin City metropolitan area, and each of them is touched in its own unique way by the regional systems and the plans for the regional systems. What Metropolitan Council does then, as stipulated by statutes, is to communicate with each local community regarding the regional plans, the plans for regional systems, and this is done via a mechanism we call system statements. In this decade, system statements were released to local communities in September of the year 2005. There is a process that is specified by statutes where communities review their system statements. They can request changes. They can make appeals. And those requests and appeals are considered, and then within a 3-month period, the systems statements become final based on that process. So by the end of the year 2005, finalized system statements were in place and in the possession of each local community. The release of system statements then is what triggers the process for revising local comprehensive plan updates, which is required by statute to be done once every 10 years by local communities. So I'm going to switch now to talking about what statute requires as elements of local comprehensive plans. And this again is work then that is done by local communities. The foundation of local comprehensive plans is a statement of policies and objectives that local communities must include. They must refer to their planning area designation that has been defined by Metropolitan Council in negotiation with local communities. But again, it basically just describes whether they're a developed community, developing, or rural. And they must include forecasts for population and household and employment numbers. that are also provided by Metropolitan Council as part of the regional planning framework. In this decade, the plans will be through the year 2030. Based on that foundation, then, there are really three major categories of components of local comprehensive plans that I'll talk about next. The first major category is the category of land use.
Excuse me, just one second. If I could just ask members, how many of you have been on city councils where you've actually done a comprehensive plan, just so that we know how much detail. So if you could keep that in mind as you make the rest of this. Sorry about that. But go ahead.
All right. So to just go through these elements rather quickly then, the first basic type of requirement is land use requirements, an inventory of existing land use, a plan for future land use, and a plan for housing, including addressing affordable housing needs. The second major category is public facilities, which actually mirrors the regional systems that are also planned for. Transportation facilities are included as one of the public facility areas. A second category of public facilities is water resources, which addresses wastewater, surface water, and water supply. And the final category of public facilities is parks, which is to address regional parks and trails as well as local parks and open spaces. The final major category then of the local comprehensive plans is an explanation of how the plan is to be implemented, which includes both regulatory tools, typically zoning, and also investments that are to occur in each local community. As the final piece of my presentation, then, I'm going to refer to one of several tools that the Metropolitan Council provides to assist local communities in their local planning. And we have tools that vary from information to financial assistance. What I'm going to speak about is an important informational tool called the Local Planning Handbook. This is, again, a statutory responsibility, and so every 10 years the council provides an item that we call the Local Planning Handbook. What we're proud of in this decade is that we've redesigned the handbook to be first and foremost an online web-based document. It has been very well received in that format, and in fact was given an outstanding planning award by the Minnesota chapter of the American Association of Planners in the year 2006. So it is now available as a web-based tool. We have made available for you to look at a hard copy version, which is being passed around. But it is primarily an interactive web tool. So that ends my presentation, unless there are other questions of me.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you can tell me what would be the cutoff for a city to be required to have a local comprehensive plan. Would it be 1,000 or 500, or what size city would not be required to do a plan?
Mr. Vander.
Yes. By statute, all communities within the metropolitan area are required to do comprehensive plan updates. Now, in practice, there are rural communities where there hasn't been much growth in the last 10 years. There isn't a lot of growth expected for the next, really, even up 20 or 30 years. And in those cases, the comprehensive plan update can be very minimal. It can be a matter of just changing, a few numbers and a few policies based relative to the last update that was done. But there really is no threshold below which a plan update is not required.
Follow-up, Representative Galvin.
Well, I have a community that's 440 people, so I'm just wondering, do they, and they don't have any staff, very, very little staff. They just have to contract out for everything. So do they have to follow the same process with that small of a community?
Mr. Vandershaft.
I'm speaking about Gem Lake. Maybe you're aware of it. I don't know.
Yes. The process, there does need to be a comprehensive plan update, but it can be a very simple matter. And what the council is considering right now is an ability to make available planning grants, which are really designed for smaller communities, so that what they often will do would be to hire a consultant to work on a plan for them. So.
All right, Representative Holberg. Thank you, Madam Chair. Given the recent changes in the housing market and the fact that we've seen far less interest in attached housing, we've seen articles about the condominium market. In my particular community, half the number of building permits that were issued in 2006 that were issued in 2004, the ratio of the attached to the single is changing rapidly. What has the Met Council done to look at their system plans, and what willingness will there be to make adjustments to affordable housing goals, et cetera, relative to the market, to the degree that Met Council's plans do not meet market demand? I think we artificially inflate and deflate valuation of land and housing products. And I'm just wondering what you've seen, what you're doing, and what you plan to do to react to the changing market.
Mr. Vandershaft.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. We do engage in forecasting for a 30-year period, and you know, certainly within any 30-year period or even shorter, there are ups and downs in the housing market. Our forecasts have been based best as possible on an understanding of demographic trends, which we believe will still, over the long term, still provide a substantial market for multifamily housing. Through the first half of this decade, our forecasts were actually very, very closely on target, and including not just, I think perhaps many of you have heard us talk about how we expect 1 million new people between the year 2000 and the year 2030 in the metropolitan area. As of the year 2005, we had added about 180,000 people in the metropolitan area, which was right on track toward 1 million people in 30 years. So we do keep very close track of what is actually happening from year to year, and we have built in a process of doing a major revision of the region's forecast at least twice a decade, and minor revisions as local communities come to us with making a case that really the forecast needs to be changed. So there are a number of ways that can be addressed as the market might change.
Follow-up, Representative Holberg.
Well, and again, what have you done in the last 6 to 8 months in looking at this mark change in the environment out there? And I mean, the numbers are just staggering as far as many communities expect to see no subdivision development in the next year or two. Many of them have lot supplies, 2, 3, 4 year lot supplies, and they're facing this comp plan update process and are very nervous relative to what they see happening in their communities and the market conditions, and they put those up against your standards that were put in place prior to any of this downfall. And I understand that you do long-term planning, but the lows can be as long as the highs. Certainly the 90s were the highs in the housing market, and most predict that we will never reach those levels again in the next decade or two, in part because of the demographics of the baby boomers as well. So what have you done in the last 6 months?
Mr. Vandershaft.
Madam Chair and committee members, what I can tell you is that Each year we do an estimate of current housing and population growth. This is also required by statutes. The most recent estimate that we have done was for the year 2005. We will start working on the estimate for the year 2006. Really, it's within a time period of March through June of this year. And that is one of the ways that we keep close tabs on what is happening on the ground from time to time. But again, we will take that into consideration and see if it merits any changes in forecasts, which again do go out to the year 2030. And we certainly, as communities develop their local comprehensive plans, they can make a case that their forecasts may need to be changed, and the council would certainly seriously consider that.
All right. I just want to introduce the 12th grade students from Princeton High School. They are participating in the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Site Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Educational Program. Welcome to our committee. All right. With that, I also have a question, unless you wanted to add something, Mr. Schitt.
No.
Okay. Typically in the past, I had heard that the Metropolitan Council was very active and even had a more higher profile when it came to planning and comprehensive plans for communities. Can you tell me, in comparison to the past, where you see your role now in planning and how different is it, and is it better or is it worse? What's the upside downside? So, Mr. Vandershaft.
Madam Chair, committee members, I think what I'd just like to do is focus on how the current council sees its role. And to kind of emphasize what I said earlier, the council currently feels that its role is very much one of being a partner with local communities. That plays out in a number of different ways. It plays out in the articulation of different policies for developed areas and developing areas. It really plays out in terms of providing local communities with a lot of leeway within the basic guidelines that are required by statute. The council currently does not see its role as going beyond what's clearly defined in state statutes.
I think Mr. Bell would like to add something to that question.
Yes.
Mr. Bell, please go ahead.
If I can, Representative Hillstrom, I think your point and observation is an important one. When I became chair of the council, quite candidly, I think there was a legitimate concern amongst a wide array of people that there was a bit of mission creep with the council. And one of the things that I have worked very hard on is trying to really make sure the council adhered to its legislative and statutory requirements. At the core, the council really is at the juncture between two what I call civic virtues. On the one hand, many communities feel, and I think somewhat appropriately, that local control is very, very important. I always joke, I've had many a mayor say to me, well, who elected you, Peter? Why do you get to come into our community and have any impact? On the other side, and I think this is an important civic value, that how a community chooses to grow and develop affects the efficient use of infrastructure and their neighbors. And really, the council exists in its planning efforts to balance those two, the efficient use of very expensive infrastructure. And if each community develops in fundamentally different ways, they will use infrastructure with varying degrees of efficiency, and that really results in a hidden tax on the entire region. That fact has to be balanced against the rights of local communities to largely grow and develop in ways that are consistent with how their citizens want to grow. And every council balances those two virtues differently. And I think the Met Council, since I have been chair, has really attempted to be very sensitive to that and to strike, I think, a balance that has reflected itself, as you've indicated, in a bit of a lower profile and not as controversial. I'd end by saying we do an annual survey of residents, and the Met Council
has the highest approval rating that it ever has amongst the broader public.
Well, Mr. Bell, I just want to comment that it's ironic that you asked, the mayor asked you who elected you, because we do have a bill that we're hearing on Monday on whether or not the Met Council should be an elected body. So
that's what I understand.
I am certain that you'll be back to testify one way or another.
I will.
All right, questions from members. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, does the Met Council keep statistics on how many comp plans are sent back for reworking, not necessarily denied, but what percentage of comp plans the first time they're submitted have to be sent back with suggestions from the Metropolitan Council?
Mr. Vandershaft.
Madam Chair, Representative, we would have that information. I don't have it at my fingertips, so we can certainly get it.
That would be great.
Madam Chair, we'll make sure we have that information available, if not before, but at the hearing on Monday. So we'll make sure we have that.
Great. Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Biskin?
Nope. That's fine. Thank you, Bill, Madam
Chair. All right. Further questions regarding this planning session? Oh, Representative Shumper.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Vandershaft, I'm from a rural area, and I've been in battles for zoning, overzoning on both sides for the last 30 years. And so, I'm really intrigued by what you're doing here, to say the least. I have just three kind of basic questions. Is every acre of land in the Seven County Metro zoned?
Mr. Vandershaft.
Madam Chair, Representative, asking the question that way, the Metropolitan Council actually doesn't keep close track of what there is in the way of zoning. We do. Our focus is more on land use, and local communities are to submit, a description of their official controls to us. But that isn't always our
okay.
What we pay most attention to. We do know that there is land use designation for each acre. Whether there's zoning or not, that again is something I don't know at the moment, but we could see what information
it was just a
Mr.
question.
Shumper, Representative Shumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What intrigues me is how do you, maybe you can explain this, how do you harmonize land use zoning across political boundaries? What if, I notice you have 44 townships, and I live in a township, and, we've had mega wars with the city of La Crescent. We share a common boundary, and over the years, you can see what happens when you don't harmonize, because the city will have residential right up to a zone in the township that might be quite different. And so how does that happen in the metro area?
Mr. Vandershaft.
Madam Chair, Representative, it happens in a couple of ways. I think most prominently, each community is required to submit their plan for review by neighboring communities as well, and neighboring communities then do have the opportunity to comment on what's going on in the community next door to them, and in very many cases this results in the ironing out of incompatibilities that may be there otherwise. Beyond that, land use designations, though, are a matter of local responsibility. The council does not impose particular land use categories on any local community. It does have some density standards that are required, in different ways, whether it's a sewered community or not. But one thing we do as a service, however, is we do an analysis of land use twice every decade based on aerial photography that we do. We take information that local communities have to identify their land use. We compare it to what we can see from the air, and we release a map that what we call a generalized land use map, so that it is the same general designation throughout the metropolitan area, with a big footnote saying this is not necessarily the same as the land use designations in an individual community. Mm-hmm. Some communities choose to adopt that as their own standard, but that's a matter of their own choice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, just to follow up then, so the council would not, based on land use on a comp plan, would not send it back to a community? It'd only send it back on zoning? I didn't quite understand the connection there. So if you could clarify that.
Mr. Vandershaft.
Madam Chair, Representative, the council certainly would review land use categories and with a special emphasis on densities to ensure that a sufficient density can be in place to support regional systems. What we would not do is review zoning categories. We would have that as a matter of information, but the council does not speak to zoning.
Representative Biskin.
Okay, I do. So for instance, if a county submits for its township a plan which would have some rural ag designated 1 in 20, another rural ag designated 1 in 40, that's irrelevant to the Metropolitan Council. What's more relevant is the rural ag designation.
Mr. Vandershaft.
Madam Chair, Representative, it would certainly be relevant what the land use category is, including the density. So 1 in 20, 1 in 40 would certainly be a matter of council review.
Representative Biskin?
That's okay, Madam Chair. I'm just confused because I thought I had heard that the zoning wasn't something the Metropolitan Council concerns itself with. So maybe we're just at crosshairs with verbiage. I don't know. So,
Mr. Vandershaft?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, land use categories and zoning categories are very closely interrelated, but there is a distinction. And, zoning categories will typically get into matters of, I mean, in a city, what building heights ought to be, what setbacks from streets ought to be, that's not a matter of Metropolitan Council review. Density, though, is, and that would be encompassed by land use classifications.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Vandershaft. Mr. Shetnan, is next?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next, I'm going to have Jan Gustafson, who is our manager of our livable communities, provide a little bit more depth into our livable communities program, and we will. I know the committee has seen and heard from this before, and we'll try to move through it at a pace that you'd appreciate.
Thank you, Mr. Shetnan. Especially if you could talk about the livable communities grant change, I believe that, and how that transpired, at least at some point in time in the presentation or at the end, that would be great.
Sure. Madam Chair, I believe what you're talking about is the levy reduction.
Yes.
I don't know when would be the appropriate time to do that. We do talk about in our legislative initiatives, livable communities initiative there, but it doesn't address the reduction. So, and I know Chairman Bell has to leave.
Okay.
He's probably the most appropriate person to discuss that. I don't know if you want to do that now.
Whenever, if you want to do it for just a few minutes, just review what you did and why you did it. And
sure.
Because I would assume those questions would come up.
Great. I think now is probably the most appropriate time.
All right,
Chair.
Mr. Bell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are proposing some legislative changes to our Livable Communities program. We have, as you know, very briefly, and Jan will expand on this, three programs. We have a Livable Communities grant program of about $8 million. We have what's called a TIBRA program. First, the Livable Communities grant program is to provide dollars, gap financing, to municipalities or to projects in municipalities, for lack of a better term, that adhere, broadly speaking, to Met Council principles. So they tend to be multi-use projects, transit-oriented development, and the like. Excelsior and Grand and St. Louis Park, Heart of the Cities in Burnsville, are probably the two examples of those type of programs.
That's one type of grant program, about $8.5 million or thereabouts that we do on an annual basis. The second program is our TIBR program, and that is about $4 million. That's essentially to clean up polluted land. And the third program is about $1.5 million that we have for affordable housing. We do that in concert with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Twin City Family Housing Fund. One of the concerns that I have had, Madam Chair, as Council, the Chair of the Metropolitan Council, as well as other Council members, is the first grant program, the Livable Communities Grant Program. This is $8 million plus for projects, the demonstration account for projects that adhere to Met Council principles. Last spring, Madam Chair, there was a great deal of concern amongst many council members, again myself included, that some of those, that the project was not meeting the original intent, which was to demonstrate programs that weren't market ripe yet and provide funding for them. We were getting requests for things like playground equipment, fountains and projects, that sort of thing. And it caused a fair amount of consternation amongst council members, including myself. What we have decided to request is two things, principally. One is a reduction in our levy, because we levy on property taxes for this, of $1 million. And while that is not significant in the overall scheme of things, the council, the administration, and I know the legislature has concerns about what's happening with property taxes, and I felt, gee whiz, if I didn't feel 100% that this project was meeting all of its intended needs, that was warranted. The second thing that we are requesting is that the council be given authority to really move dollars from the demonstration account to the TIBR account, which cleans up polluted land, so that we would be able to make a determination that in any given year we need $5 million in the TIBR account or $6 million to clean up polluted lands in the TIBR account rather than the four and a half that we have now. So it would provide us, for lack of a better term, Madam Chair, flexibility between the demonstration account and the TIBR account, in addition to lowering the amount that we levy by $1 million. We're not asking, and this is an important point, a reduction in our levy authority. So if we decide in the future that we want to increase that back to its previous level, we would be allowed to do that. So we're not asking for a reduction in that. We have taken upon ourselves, really it's a restraint on ourselves, to levy $1 million less in that account. And what we're asking for, Madam Chair, is the flexibility to go between those two accounts.
All right. Questions? Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this kind of a recognition of my memory is that the demonstration account kind of came to be in the when the new urbanism and all that was hot and everybody was going to try these new high-density mixed-use developments, and some of the examples are the St. Louis Park project, and now we've been seeing parking lots and other things being funded with this money, and that there's really no burning need for all these new great ideas to be demonstrated, and that we've already done it and there's nothing on the horizon.
Mr. Bell.
Representative Hillstrom, Representative Holberg, that's going further than I'd go. I am not prepared to say that. What I am prepared to say is that we need to take a hard look at this program. And Representative Hillstrom, Representative Holberg, that's really what I intend to do. I have contacted people at the University of Minnesota, and I'm working very closely with them to help me look at that program, to see if it is on focus, to see what kind of changes we should make. Quite candidly, I think the changes will be minor. I don't think there'll be a radical transformation of them, but I think it's warranted. I think we should never allow government grants or programs to go on forever unexamined. And really, for lack of a better term, I want to take a year, Representative Hillstrom and Representative Holberg, and look at the program. I want to do it in concert with the University of Minnesota and with the Met Council.
Great. Representative Holbrook.
And just in follow-up, and that's why I'm kind of surprised why you just went do away with it instead of doing the transfer. And so I know we have limited time here today and that we're going to hear a bill that would allow for this to happen. And I guess I would be interested in seeing what your unmet needs were in the tax-based revitalization account to justify this kind of increased spending. If you know, if you had three times the amount of applications and you had money, I mean, I'd like to see a case for that as opposed to reducing the levy or the amount spent and spending it on something of a greater need for the metropolitan area.
Representative Hillstrom, Representative Holbrook, I think that's a fair request. I will tell you quite candidly, the volume of requests we have in the demonstration account is higher. I mean, we have more requests than that than we do in our TIBRA account. Our request is simply to give us flexibility to move dollars from one account to the other. That's really what we would be requesting.
Okay, so a follow-up to that. If we could actually find out how many applications you had as part of it and then how many are funded, that would be helpful.
Representative Hillstrom, we will provide that. One last note is important to add that the AMM does support our change here. We've worked with them closely on this.
Okay, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine is actually not to this point, but I heard that the chairman might be leaving and not here when we get to that portion, and so I don't know if you'd entertain a question on the transit portion.
Mr. Bell, would you be willing? All right, Representative Hausman.
Representative Oberstar was in town yesterday getting a lot of attention with his challenge to the state to maximize federal dollars. And I don't know if this amount is correct, but I understand Dallas is getting $700 million this year to build its transit corridors, and of course that puts them at an economic advantage in terms of competitiveness. What kind of leadership role do you and or the Met Council play, or what do you expect to provide to assure state funding matches for those federal dollars, and what is the timetable?
Mr. Bell.
Representative Hillstrom, Representative Hausman, I was there for the hearing with Representative Oberstar yesterday. The issue of matching dollars is, candidly and bluntly, much more of a concern with MnDOT than it is with us. We get federal formula dollars to run our bus system. We have never had a problem with matching those dollars. There are federal formula dollars that come by virtue of how many riders you have and how many buses that you have. Our CMAC dollars, which are to deal with issues of air quality and the like, we have not had a problem matching those dollars, nor have we had a problem in matching dollars for our transit system, either the Hiawatha line, North Star, nor do I anticipate problems for the Central Corridor. The issue of matching dollars, frankly, has been more of an issue and concern with MnDOT than it has with us.
Representative House.
Madam Chair and Chairman Bell, just to zero in on the one most immediate right now, Central Corridor. At this point, the Governor and the Met Council are not asking for any dollars this year to match federal money. Is that correct?
Mr. Bell.
Representative Hillstrom, Representative Hausman, that is correct, but I would add two important points. While it is not in the budget, the passage of MVEST and in the governor's budget, he has included the sales tax from license fees as well, which will add about $67 million, would allow, from leased vehicles, would allow us to provide some of the state match. In addition to that, we, in the past two bonding bills, have had dollars to go into the Central Corridor. So, in sum, the previous bonding dollars would be allowed to provide some federal match. And in addition to that, the passage of MVEST would allow the Met Council to contribute dollars. And we are in preliminary engineering now, which will take 2 years. The cost of preliminary engineering is $45 million. I met with the FTA a week ago, the head of the FTA. I actually mentioned to him that the governor did not have in his budget this year any dollars, any capital dollars for the Central Corridor. I told him not to be concerned about that, one, because we're in preliminary engineering, two, because MVEST had passed, and we would be able to use some of those dollars, and that was not a concern to him. We get into final design and the full funding grant agreement. You can't get the full funding grant agreement, as you well know, until we have all of the local and state dollars accounted for.
And Madam Chair, Chairman Bell, that's why I asked about timetable, because that is a fairly aggressive ask. And do we do that all in 1 year? Or do we spread that over several years? And can you, my understanding is that you're proposing that MVEST money be spent partially for operating, and that wouldn't necessarily be available for capital. Can you give me dollar amounts that you believe are available?
Mr. Bell.
Representative Hillstrom, Representative Hausman, from the state, to answer your last question first, from the state, we're going to need about $280 million. We are looking, and I don't want to be held firmly to these figures, but about half of that coming from the geobonds and half of that coming from MVEST. So about 140 and 140. 140 from the MVEST, and you are correct, Representative, in saying some of the MVEST dollars will be used for operations. Some of it will be used for capital. We anticipate we will be able to do adhere to our 2020 plan, which does our first-tier transitways, which includes the Central Corridor, if we get $140 million of bonding from the state. The Met Council would put in about $140. Now, I don't want to be held strictly to this because these numbers may float around a bit. And that is based on, this is an important point, that is based on a couple of very important things. The project being in the 810 to 820 range are getting the 38-2 split from the motor vehicle sales tax, where the 38% of the transfer part comes to the Met Council, 2% goes to Greater Minnesota, are two important considerations that my remarks are based on.
And Madam Chair, I'd just like to add that it also, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hausman, that also is dependent on the sales tax and leased vehicle monies being included as part of that 38-2.
And one follow-up?
And Madam Chair, just to the committee, and my reason for raising these questions in this context, I think, was to get a sense, because you're talking about Metropolitan Council and its role, you know, what is their role in planning, what is their role in leadership, what is their role in advocacy for funding, that I wanted to get some concept from them about.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. Representative Lincheski also has a question for Mr. Bell. Representative Lincheski.
Mr. Bell, you should have planned to spend more time here. nice to see you, and just a couple questions, or one question, but something Mr. Shetland just said, just to get it on the record here with the committee, that dependency on the sales tax from the leased vehicle, you know, the tax committee has other designs on that set of dollars, so just so you know, I mean, and as you're planning this through, I mean, we've not ever done something like this, that what the governor is proposing, and we were surprised to see that provision not in the actual proposal before the tax committee, and we'll be bringing it back, because members know who have tracked this issue, it's a sales tax, it's not a transportation piece, so we will have that debate in the tax committee as to where that money is going to be used. But I do want to ask you on the livable communities demonstration account. You said you want to have a bill come forward to move money from the demonstration to the tax-based revitalization account. And I don't know who your author is, and I haven't seen that bill. But what I would, you know, and I know we'll spend time on it in taxes, but I do want the committee, as you look through these slides, the different accounts all say they're funded by the metro-wide property tax. And that's technically true. But they're funded by different types of property taxpayers in the metro, and it's not breaking out that fiscal disparities is paying for some, and residents across the metro are paying for other, and so when they're just, it's the property taxpayers of the metro, we're talking about different groups, and these accounts are set up differently. So to just move money from here to here is telling these taxpayers to now take the money that was levied for this thing and pay for that thing, which that's why the legislation has to come here. And I think for the local government committee's purposes, you know, I'm sure that bill will come here. But in the end, it also becomes a tax debate. And I just don't want members to see the slides. And if you want to comment, Mr. Bell, because it says all of the accounts just come from Metro taxpayers, and they're very different Metro taxpayers.
Representative Lincheski, I am actually carrying the Metropolitan Council's bills as a courtesy as the chair of the committee. And so we will be having all of those debates. And considering I'm on the committee and on your committee, I look forward to a full discussion of all of them. So, Mr. Bell, if you have a comment.
Well, very quickly, Chair Hillstrom and Representative Lincheski, your point is well taken. I think that we do need to drill down further in that. As you know, the Tibera counter to clean up polluted lands comes from the disparities, tax-based disparities portion, whereas we do levy for the demonstration account. And I think that we need to provide that kind of transparency and clarity. We just want flexibility in using the dollars. We think that as grants come through, quite candidly, some years there are strong demonstration account programs or projects, and other years the projects aren't as strong, and there might be very strong programs or needs for cleaning up of polluted lands. And we want to be able to have some flexibility with that is really what we're requesting. But your point is very well taken, and that type of transparency will be provided.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you. And I know we'll spend time on it later, so I'll leave it at that. I just didn't want this committee. The difference is, if you think of all the properties in the metro, whether they're commercial or homeowners or, you know, utilities or whatever, in some of these accounts, everybody in the metro pays. In other accounts, very few properties pay, and very few cities pay, and then they're buying things for the whole metro. So there is a disparity within these accounts that, as you can imagine, many cities feel very strongly about, depending on whether or not they're paying them. And so it breaks up very different for the 138 cities. And I'm glad to hear that you at least recognize that there's a very big political dimension to this situation.
All right. Further questions for Mr. Bell before he leaves? You might want to leave quick. No. Actually, go ahead and continue with the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question to you is, would you like us to spend more time on livable communities, or would you prefer we move on to our info and infiltration presentation and then our drinking water supply presentation?
Do members have any more questions on the Livable Communities Act? The slides are pretty self-explanatory. That's fine. If you'd like to move on, that's great.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll invite Bill Moore up here, who's our General Manager of Environmental Services. And just as a note to Representative Lincheski, that we're very well aware of that, and we knew that we were going to have to come see you in the tax committee as well. So we're not trying to pull anything on anybody here, but we had this conversation with Representative Hillstrom when we talked to her about the bill, and our friends at AMM or Metro Cities are very well aware of this as well. So we're hoping to come forward with something that we can all agree to, and hopefully we can do very well in the tax committee as well. So thank you, Madam Chair. And with me is Mr. Moore, and I'll turn this over to him.
All right, Mr. Moore, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. It's my pleasure to be here and talk to you about infiltration inflow as we load our slides up.
It's coming.
Just be talking about basically six areas with respect to infiltration inflow. One, I want to give you a little bit of background on what it actually is. Talk about a task force of our ratepayers that we work with to develop policies to deal with this issue. Talk about the approaches that you can deal with it, either locally or regionally. I want to talk sometime about the INI surcharge program itself, the communities that are impacted, and future activities coming up. So. Let me just start with a map of our wastewater system, and so you can understand a little bit about what we're working with here. This is color-coded, so the color coding relates to the service area for a particular treatment plant. So the areas that are colored are the areas that the Metropolitan Council provides service to, wastewater service to. And it consists of 104 communities. The Metro plant, which is in green, is our largest facility, and that actually in itself serves 65 communities. We have seven other plants, and on an average daily day, we treat somewhere between 275 to 300 million gallons per day. We have 600 miles of interceptor sewer. That's the large pipes that conveys the wastewater to our system. In there, there's also 61 pumping stations, 190 flow metering stations, which are needed to actually bill the communities for the wastewater that they put into the system. So what is infiltration inflow? This map illustrates some sources of it. It's essentially clear water that enters the system, and it takes up capacity in the sanitary sewer pipes. It doesn't need to be treated and actually causes some problems. It can enter in a number of areas. You can see there's an example house there, and some homes actually have their rain gutters that drain right into the sanitary sewer system to get rid of the water. Those are called rain leaders. A lot of houses have foundation drains to keep them dry. Oftentimes it's sump pumped back into the sanitary sewer, again, because that's just a convenient way to get rid of the water out of the yard and out of the basement. Some older homes actually have gravity connections from the basement drains right into the sanitary sewer pipe, and that's actually a little bit harder to deal with. You can have cracks in the pipes itself. It can be from the home going to the trunk lines. The joints can break apart. There can be settlement, and groundwater can infiltrate into the pipes. Same thing with manholes. You can have cracks in the manholes or in the joints, and water can leak in. And in some cases, you actually have cross connections between a storm sewer system that drains the storm water into the sanitary sewer, and that's not a proper connection. But in some of the older cities, that was a common way of dealing with storm water, particularly Minneapolis and St. Paul. But even other cities have done that inadvertently. So those are basically the main issues associated with where INI comes from. Now, why is it a problem? This is a cross-section of a pipe, and it shows you how we actually design our facilities to accommodate wastewater. And there'll be a base flow, which would be the flow that comes into our system on an average day from a community. We'll also provide in there a peaking factor so that wastewater isn't a constant flow into a pipe. It'll vary during the day, and so because of that, there's a peak factor to make sure that we have enough capacity for those events. We also recognize that there's a certain amount of infiltration that will come into the system anyway. When you lay pipes underground, you're going to get some leakage, so there is an allowance for infiltration into the normal sewer design. And then the rest of that capacity is for growth, so that's basically how you lay out your pipes. You accommodate the current situation and allow for growth. What INI does essentially is, depending on how excessive it is, it can actually take up some or all of the growth capacity. And in the worst case situation, it actually spills out into the streets or streams, so that into an overflow situation. So that's really why you're concerned about it. It can cause you some significant problems, and I'll just try to highlight what those are. And essentially, again, it eliminates the capacity intended for regional growth. You can have backups in homes if that capacity is full of INI into the system. There's no room for the wastewater from a homeowner to flow into the system, so it backs up into a basement. Extreme events, it can overflow into streets and streams and lakes. And it actually, for an agency or a city, it can expose you to regulatory enforcement action, because those are illegals, overflows are illegal, and either the state or the EPA can actually take action on you. And in fact, the Environmental Protection Agency's biggest area for water enforcement is sanitary sewer overflows. Now, recognizing that this isn't a new problem, the Metropolitan Council has been trying to work on this for a number of years, and has provided some incentives and even some grants to cities in the past to try to rectify this, but we've only made certain amount of progress, and there's still a large amount of excessive INI in the system. Some cities have done a good job and others haven't. In 2003, we assembled a task force to see if there's we could come up with a mechanism for dealing with this particular issue, and we had the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities and 14 cities to work with the Metropolitan Council to come up with some guidelines on this. And the cities were broken up into cities that actually did not have a problem and cities that did have significant INI, so you'd have a balanced perspective from the ratepayers.
Excuse me, just 1 second. Representative Biskin, did you have a question?
Thank you. Back one slide on the reasons for excessive INI removal. I noticed you didn't list up there the cost of treating water. I know when I was a city council member in the city of Jordan, you know, we looked at cost of treating water into the system as a big factor for why we needed to remove that. Is that not an issue, or just five looked good and balanced and six would have put it out of balance?
Mr. Moore.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, cost is an issue, but those are really the major issues of having overflows and backups are environmental and public health related issues, as well as federal enforcement issues. And even though there is some extra cost in the system, when that flow comes into our system, we meter that and we will bill the community back for the cost of treating that. So even though there are some extra costs, that the community that has that ends up paying for it.
All right. Please continue.
Now, one of the things the task force looked at is what is the best way to handle this. We did hire a national consulting firm to assist us with this, and they did some cost estimating. And there's really two approaches you can take to deal with INI. You can decide to deal with it at the regional level, and what that means is you have to handle the flow that comes into the system, and you either you fill up your pipes to its maximum capacity, and what's left over you have to store it and then bleed it back into the system when the flow goes down. All of that has to be treated at the wastewater treatment plants, and the estimate that we have is $900 million to do that. If the INI is not taken out at the local level, the Metropolitan Council would have to build storage facilities at different parts within our system and also expand our treatment plants. Now, this is a system or an approach that several cities have taken, notably Milwaukee and Chicago, and they've spent billions of dollars on trying to deal with INI storage and treatment. So we think our numbers are fairly reasonable here and probably even on the lower end. On the other hand, if this can be taken care of at the source and the community can deal with its INI locally, we estimate the cost to be significantly less at about $150 million. The task force spent about a year working on this, and they did come to a number of conclusions, and they're listed here. One is, they've looked at our data and how we size our pipes and how we allow for a certain amount of INI, and the task force concluded that our design standard is reasonable, and when you compare it to other standards around, we're more conservative or actually allow more INI in the system as an allowance than other standards would allow. The task force also concluded that communities that have excess INI really should be accountable for dealing with that and paying for it. Given the cost difference between dealing with this at a regional level where it was $900 million or dealing with it at a local level, they concluded that it made sense to deal with it at a local level. And in fact, if you looked at this $900 million cost, if the region would pick that up, that cost gets distributed back to the communities that are in the system. And they would actually, if you had INI, you would end up paying more if we did it anyway. And cities that didn't have INI would pay a lot more. So it just made sense to try to approach this on a local level. And finally, the fourth thing is they recommended that we adopt a surcharge program that actually obtains the money necessary to do the work. And so going forward, the Metropolitan Council did adopt the task force recommendations and did adopt a surcharge. And here's a series of events that we went through. I just want to illustrate that this wasn't a real quick decision. We spent a lot of time dealing with communities on this, having public meetings and public outreach. Yes.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Moore, can you explain then how the surcharge program works? If you're saying that this has to be dealt with at a local level, and I agree with that policy, deal with it at the local level, then what would be the necessity for charging a region surcharge for something that should be done at the local level? And maybe that also ties into how you enforce local compliance. Because you said, or do you have other tools that you use to enforce local compliance?
Mr. Moore.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, the next three or four slides I have kind of go over the elements of the surcharge program, so hopefully they'll okay. answer your question. But the basic principle of it is that the communities that have the excess INI would be the ones that are surcharged. So this would be a specific surcharge based on the amount of INI that any city would have. It's not a regional charge, it's a city charge.
Okay.
The way it's set up, it's for a five-year period from 2007 to 2011. So this is the first year that it actually would be implemented. And the methodology that we used is that it's based on the based on the actual peak events that occurred. And what we do is we meter the flow from every community so we know when there's a INI event that exceeds our design standards. Whenever a city exceeds that, we would notify them in writing that they've exceeded it. But starting on June 1st, 2004, we've set that as the date. Whatever the peak event that occurred after that would be the basis for setting the surcharge program. So it's the highest event that we monitor. And you may, from the period 2004 to 2007, each city on our list would have a peak flow event that they'll be charged for. That could change over time if there's a worse event 2 years down the road and their surcharge might increase. On the other hand, they might be able to solve the problem and get off the surcharge list. One of the philosophies we use is that the exceedance rate will be the same for all communities, so we didn't really try to custom fit it for each community and say it would cost this much to take it out of your system. We said there would be a uniform rate, and it was really based on the fact that we did some engineering estimates that roughly $3,000 would be required to fix a house that has an illegal connection to the sewer system, whether it be a sump pump or a foundation drain. And that's an average. Sump pumps could be fixed for a couple hundred dollars. Foundation drains might take $5,000 or $6,000. So $3,000 was the average. And then it was assumed that that would take out 6 gallons per minute for the fix. And what it turns out to be is the surcharge cost would then be $350,000 for every million gallons of excess INI in the system. So each community would then be monitored. You know how much in terms of million gallons per day that they have excess INI, and that's how their surcharge would be calculated. That's for 2007. As we go forward with the program, there'll be adjustments for inflation and maybe some engineering adjustments. Now, there's also a mechanism for dealing with appeals because not all cities will agree. All cities agree that INI should come out of the system. No one argues that, but they don't necessarily agree that the INI is all their fault or they agree with our numbers. So there are a number of ways that a city could actually modify their surcharge. One is if there's extenuating circumstances that cause the event, and I can give you an example of one city where they just had one peak event from June 2004 to 2007, and they maintained it was really caused by MnDOT construction, and that it turned out after an investigation, MnDOT was doing some work along one of their freeway projects, had been relocating some manholes. Those manholes were left open. There was a 4-inch rain event, so a tremendous amount of wastewater or rainwater actually flowed into the open manhole. And so it was a one-time occurrence. Didn't make any sense to surcharge that community. And when it was investigated, it came off the list. So there are circumstances like that can occur. Also, a city can come in and say or demonstrate to us that they agree with the INI, but the fix or the $350,000 per million gallon that we're allocating as a surcharge, they may say that they can do it cheaper than that. It may, in fact, be possible. And as long as they can show an engineering basis for that, we would adjust the surcharge based on what they think they can do. Also, there's credits that we'll give cities starting in 2004 for activities that they've done. We would actually credit that against their surcharge, provided that it met certain criteria. And if we determine things to be ineligible, they certainly would have an opportunity to appeal that and make their case.
How much money did you raise through this surcharge?
Madam Chair, I'll
Mr. Moore,
get to that with my last slide, but to steal my thunder, there actually will be no surcharge in 2007 for reasons that I will explain. Going back to the appeal process, we also put in a limit there that 25% cap would be applied if the city wanted to do that. In other words, if the surcharge was over 25%, they could have that time extended. They'd still have to make the corrective fix for the surcharge dollar amounts, but they could get longer time by capping it to 25%. The next list shows the communities that were notified that they would have a surcharge in 2007. And it's 45 communities. But one of the options we have in the program is if the city does demonstrate that they have plans in place to take care of INI, have a program in place that's documented, that the work is budgeted, or if they simply make a commitment by a city council resolution to spend that money during 2007, then we would not surcharge them. And you go to the next slide, you can see that 42 of those communities actually developed work plans, and three of them developed resolutions that said they would commit to spend the money. And as long as they were committing to spend the money, the council would then not surcharge them. Any money that the council would actually surcharge to a community would go into a special account and would actually be rebated back to them when they do INI elimination work. So this would not be a situation where the Metropolitan Council would actually get any money. We're basically raising the money and then sending it back to the cities to correct the problem. But in this case, virtually every city said they'd rather control their own money than send it to us. And so I think the program is moving forward the way that we hoped it would. We would rather not surcharge people. We would rather have them take care of it without us surcharging it. And it appears that the surcharge was a good enough incentive to get cities moving in that direction.
All right, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Moore, how much money in surcharges is currently squirreled away by the Metropolitan Council?
Mr. Moore.
For rebate purposes.
Representative Biskins, 2007 was the first year that the surcharge program was proposed. And as this last slide showed, no communities will be surcharged, so there is nothing there.
Representative Biskins, follow-up?
There is, all right. So because the reason I was asking that is I wonder how the Metropolitan Council is going to deal with cities that just say, no, you know, we're not going to comply. We don't agree with you. We're not going to pay the surcharge. We'll continue, and you're not going to put a big stopper in the pipe and say, well, you can't use it. So what tools would you then use? Would you deny permits to add development into the system? Would you, what kind of tools are at your disposal, Mr. Moore?
Mr. Moore.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, there are a number of tools. I mean, we do have the ability to collect money from cities and have the legal authority to actually put a tax on if they do not pay their bills. We've never had to do that. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, and in the Water Resources Policy Plan, we've made it clear that if cities don't take the steps to do it, that actually eliminating or not approving sewer system extensions in the future would be the enforcement tool. So it is a pretty significant tool, and again, we'd rather not use that and have the cities take care of it, but that would really be the teeth behind the program.
Follow-up, Representative.
Just one final question then, Mr. Moore. Has the council ever contemplated actually going into a community and doing the INI reduction work themselves and then charging the communities back for the work that's been done?
Mr. Moore.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, no, we haven't. I think that would cause certain problems. We actually don't have the rights to go into a local sewer system and do that. We can fix our system and spend money on our system, but we can't do that on a local system.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this presentation. I know some people might consider this to be rather boring, but as a former city official, I'm heartened to see what Met Council is doing to try and address this problem of infiltration and inflow. One of the things that you haven't talked about in terms of problems that inflow creates is that during periods of heavy runoff where you've got storm and sanitary sewers connected, you end up with raw sewage going directly into our streams, our rivers. And if you don't have a program like this, we're contributing to impaired waters around the state. And I guess I would be concerned that if you don't do what you're doing, that then maybe people would be looking for some clean water legacy funds to do what these communities ought to be doing on their own. And I think as we go forward in trying to address providing resources for clean water legacy, that we pay attention to how well this is working, and that if communities are not doing what they need to do, you may need some additional enforcement mechanisms to make sure that happens. Otherwise, that everybody in the state ends up having to foot the bill for what communities that haven't done their job should be. So maybe you want to comment on that.
Okay, Mr. Moore.
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, I probably did low-key the point of the impact of the INI when I was talking about backups in a home or overflows into lakes and streams. I mean, that really is the driver behind trying to do the program. Also, if you know, any community that doesn't deal with INI when they build a wastewater treatment plant, they'll either make it bigger than it has to, which is going to cost the state and the local community more money, or they're going to make it too small and they'll fail standards. So one way or the other, you really have to deal with INI. And I think this is a program we feel very good about because our ratepayers really helped us develop it. And one of the things we were concerned about is you don't really want to do this and alienate your ratepayers who have to do this. But the reality is when you have 104 communities in the system and 55% of them don't have INI, and they end up having to pay the cost for the communities that do have it. And so there's a basic equity issue that we were trying to address here also.
All right. Mr. Shetman, you have 5 minutes, and you have two sets of slides left in our packet. I don't think you'll get through them all in 5 minutes, so I suggest you prioritize on what you'd like to talk about in the next 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. What I'd like to do is quickly just add one more point about our INI program. I'd like Mr. Moore to briefly explain there was an issue, a similar issue, prior to us moving forward with this INI program with the city of Forest Lake that had a very large problem with INI. They went in and were able to fix their program themselves, and they have not had any event ever since they went in and made their fix to deal with INI. So we've shown that this program actually will work. We were at a point with the city that they were asking for additional development and different things, and things were in a real bad way for the city of Forest Lake. And with some help from the council and working with the city, we were able to get that turned around, and they are showing virtually no INI in their entire system at this point. So we're very proud of that and very proud of the city that they took those steps. Now, moving on, you're correct, we don't have a whole lot of time. What I guess I would like to do is spend, I guess, maybe a minute on passing out. I'll explain here real briefly. Back in 2005, we had a drinking water supply initiative that the council initiated here at the legislature. We were able to get this passed, and one of the requirements of our initiative was, this was carried by Representative Osmond and Senator Linda Higgins. And one of the things that we were required to do is to present a report to the legislature, which we did in January. However, Mr. Moore can spend a little bit of time on that if you'd like. To be honest with you, I don't think there's any way we're going to get through any of this in the next 4 minutes. So if you would like to take a look at that report, that would be great. And we'll be back before your committee very many times, I'm sure, many more times here in the next few weeks. So if you have questions, then we'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, I don't think we can do justice to our appreciations if we hustle through them. But everything we have is included in your packets, and everybody around the table, I believe, knows how to get a hold of me, and I'd be happy to come up and visit with each one of you individually if you would like. But with that, I appreciate the opportunity to come before your committee today, and it's always we really appreciate the opportunity to talk about things like INI and drinking water and our land planning, because the legislature always seems to be very interested, and we're happy to participate.
All right. I'm Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question that maybe can help answer later, but we just received the auditor's report on water management statewide, and I would be interested in finding out what Met Council's take is on that report and what Met Council's assessment is of the metropolitan water management organizations and watersheds. I have some real concerns about how we're handling water management issues statewide, and I would find it very helpful to get Met Council's perspective on that.
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, we would be happy to come see you and spend some time with you if you'd like to have that individually, or else if you'd like us to come back to the committee and talk about it on a broader scale, we can, but I can run up to your office and set something up here by the end of the day.
All right. Mr. Shetland, as well, if you have a memo or something that you'd
Absolutely.
Like to weigh in on, it would be helpful.
Yep.
You get it to me. I would distribute it to the members of the committee.
Absolutely.
I just want to make one announcement to the members of the committee that we are having one day of Metropolitan Council bill hearings. We are hearing everything that is introduced. And so if you haven't dropped it in the hopper yet, get it in. And if you get it in by the day that we have the hearing, I will put it on the agenda with X's. I want to take care of Met Council issues on one day. I do not want to continue to rehash these issues over the entire session. So with that, if there are no further questions from members, this meeting is adjourned.